Hi, I'm Juliet Frumholt with this week's faculty reading from the Antioch Writers' Workshop. Today we'll hear from Jerry Dennis, a freelance writer celebrated for his work about nature and the great outdoors. He's written 11 books and numerous articles for National Geographic, Audubon, and Smithsonian, among others. Here he shares an essay about a memorable winter in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
There was a winter in 1977 and 78 when 32 feet of snow fell on the Upper Peninsula. And I'm calculating the ceiling's 25 feet. That was total snowfall. It was never that much on the ground at one time. It settled, and maybe there was a little meltage, but it was a lot of snow. And that was the winter that my wife and I moved to the Upper Peninsula. We drove up to Marquette to go to school, and that was the welcome we received. So this is a little essay about that first winter. We drove into Marquette for the first time on a bright January day in 1977 when fog had slipped in from Lake Superior and left everything it touched covered with a furry coat of rime. Snowbanks stood so high along the streets that pedestrians walking on them could have reached up and touched the telephone wires. Although Marquette is the largest city in the Upper Peninsula, it is a small and compact town built on hills that drop abruptly to the shore of Superior. In a typical winter, it receives 18 or 20 feet of snow. When the wind is up and from the north, it charges from Ontario across 150 miles of open lake, throwing plumes of spray hundreds of feet inland and laminating every surface with ice. It is a place shaped and colored by weather. Our second winter there, we rented an apartment a few blocks from downtown in an aging house we shared with three young men, a student and two lapsed students, who quickly became friends and began sharing our meals, music, books, and enthusiasm for the outdoors. The boys, capitalized, as Gail called them, were veterans of several Marquette winters. They took us cross-country skiing in the Yellow Dog Plains and snowshoeing to frozen Laughing Whitefish Falls and drove us to a local ski resort after it had closed for the night, where we hurtled down the slopes on dinner trays we had stolen from the university cafeteria. "Wait until it storms," they said. "You've never seen a blizzard until you've seen a Lake Superior blizzard." We woke one January morning that second year to find the temperature outside had fallen to 35 degrees below zero. A few miles inland, it was 50 below. When I stepped outside, I saw people up and down the street trying without success to start their cars, their hoods in the air like arms thrown up in surrender. Our 10-year-old van started without difficulty, and I passed a neighborly hour giving jump starts. In the few minutes it took to step outside and attach the jumper cables to a battery, my ears, fingers, and toes would go numb, and my nostrils would swell with what felt like cotton bowls the size of walnuts. Most of the neighbors were students from southern Michigan who had never experienced such cold. We exchanged wondering comments, watching as the breath that hung around our heads crystallized and fell to the ground as fine snow. The storm came a few weeks later. Clouds moved in that morning, and the temperature climbed to the upper 20s, warmer than it had been in a month. The streets were coated with ice formed by snow that had been packed by traffic and frozen until it was as hard as concrete. All day, the light was soft and strange. On television, the weatherman grinned and said, "Get ready, folks. It looks like we're in for a blinger." It was reason, of course, for a party. We telephoned friends and told them to bring food and sleeping bags, then laced on our ice skates and sashayed down the middle of the street to the Red Owl supermarket, where we were met at the door by a weary manager who put up his hands and said, "Hey, hey, this ain't skate world." Inside, we slid around the aisles in our stocking feet, loading a grocery cart with beer, chips, and frozen dinners, greeting everyone we met. Young people were animated and talkative, their eyes bright. Old folks acted the way they always acted. We had noticed already that the people who boasted loudest about the difficulties of winters in the Upper Peninsula were usually recent immigrants, many of them from Detroit, a 450-mile drive south of Marquette, where winters are cold and damp but often free of measurable snowfall. Natives of the UP, many of them descended from Finns, Swedes, and Italians who moved to the region in the 19th century to work in the mines, were apparently too acclimated to the weather to give it much thought. To them, winter was not a romantic adventure or a Courier Knives abstraction, but a fact of life, like unemployment, taxes, and backaches. Their stoicism could be extreme. Our second autumn in Marquette, I worked for 6 months repairing railroad tracks on the Chicago Northwestern line near Ishpeming, a town 15 miles inland from Marquette. Our crew of three included two native Upers, career railroaders who dreamed of being promoted to brakemen so they could spend their days riding in a heated caboose. I was taking a semester off from college to work and was grateful for the job, but I have never been so uncomfortable. It was a frigid, snowy November, and the wind was relentless. In the cold, the steel tracks cracked under the pressure of cars loaded with iron ore pellets. Our job was to remove the broken sections and replace them with lengths of new rail. We did this by hand, unbolting existing track with four-foot-long wrenches, cutting broken sections away with a gasoline-powered hacksaw, driving new spikes with sledgehammers. On a day when the wind was particularly brutal and a harsh sleet lashed our faces, I groaned and muttered something like, "Man, this is miserable." I sensed immediate disapproval from the others. Nothing was said, but it was clear that I had violated a code. But for the boys and Gail and me, no such codes applied, and we allowed ourselves to be awed by the weather. Outside the supermarket, it had begun snowing, hard pellets that sheared at angles when the wind gusted, then dropped straight down and bounced along the street like excited molecules. By the time we got home, the wind blew with so much force that our house swayed, causing the water in the toilet bowl to rise and fall. The plastic sheeting our landlord had nailed over the windows bucked and snapped. We turned up the music, made dinner, drank beer, laughed, and danced. Friends arrived, loaded with groceries and talking in disbelief about the rising storm. Everyone took turns going to the door to watch the city become erased by whiteness. Gusts lifted snow into marauding clouds that swirled down the street and eddied into the openings between the houses, building drifts that by morning would reach to the eaves. Then stronger winds funneled in from the lake, carrying snow and streamers so blinding we couldn't see the houses across the street. One friend came late, red-faced and huffing, stomping his feet on the floor to get circulation back in his toes. He had abandoned his car and adrift blocks away. "No way," he said, "is anybody going anywhere tonight." We made up the couches into beds and spread sleeping bags on the floor. The moment we switched off the lights, the wind came up louder than ever. It seemed to bellow with triumph. In the morning, the windows were covered with elaborate, finely patterned frost shaped like ferns. We scraped it with our fingernails, and it fell in curls to the carpet. Breathing on the glass opened face-size holes that allowed us to look outside. The wind continued to blow, whipping storms of loose snow down the street. All the trees were bent with their backs to the wind and looked naked and shocked. Even the telephone poles appeared to be bent over in misery. Our neighbors' houses seemed deserted, their driveways filled with drifts that covered cars to their roofs. Someone turned on the radio, and an announcer said in a cheerful voice that classes at the university were canceled and that the state police had blocked all highways out of the city. It was perfect. It was why we had come to Marquette, to be tested by extremes of nature, to watch the world throw tantrums. Staying warm in the midst of all that cold and wind made us feel capable and self-reliant and mildly heroic. We turned up the music and danced around the living room, cheering for ourselves. We were brewing coffee and scrambling eggs when someone walked onto our porch and knocked. We opened the inner door, then pushed hard on the storm door to break through the drift that had built in front of it. A swirl of snow and cold came inside. Standing before us were two middle-aged women in bulky, snow-plastered coats, headscarves knotted tightly beneath their chins. They looked like Russian peasants dressed to go to the market. Behind them, clouds of snow roared down the street. The ladies smiled shyly. In the lilting Finnish accent of a native, one of them said, "We're collecting for the United Way." My friends and I were flabbergasted. "Did you walk here?" we asked. "Yeah, down the street. It's our day for collecting." It was unthinkable to turn them away. We invited them inside and filled their donation envelopes with pocket change. We offered them coffee and breakfast, but they couldn't stay. They had many houses to visit, they said, and because of the condition of the streets, they would have to do all their visiting on foot. And they wanted to be finished in time to have supper ready when their husbands came home from work. Thank you.